much for inviting me. It's a huge honor to be here. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing here, but I'll do my best. So I'd like to start with a few lines written by one of the best-known Hungarian poets, Attila József, from his poem Welcome to Palace Man. And by the way, these are going to be the best lines of poetry you'll hear from me tonight. You know this well, the poet never lies. The real is not enough. Through its disguise, tell us the truth, which fills the mind with light. Because without each other, all is night. These lines kept coming up in my mind as I was planning my reading here tonight. The real is not enough. Tell us the truth, which fills the mind with light. But what is truth? And especially, what is my truth? I was invited here today as a migrant poet and as a poetry critic working on migrant poetry. I have many ideas about what this term migrant poetry means, but most of it is academic, addressing the reality of the migrant experience in Ireland today. I feel I need to go somehow deeper and talk about truth. But the only truth I know is my truth. And even that is not always easy to access, and it's not always articulate. My migrant truth resides in confusion, change, loneliness, abandonment, but also in connection, peace, family, and friendship. When I was co-editing the Landing Places anthology with Eva Burke, it struck me how few of the migrant poets were writing about the migrant experience. When they did, it was often very powerful, like in this short excerpt by the Zimbabwean Nyeredzo Masunda, who I hear was here a few weeks ago. This is called Walk My Walk. Before you walk my walk, take my boots. Do you feel the tightness? Do you feel the stones piercing through? Do you feel the thorns? This is the walk I walk. Before you talk my talk, take my stage. Do you feel the nerves? Do you feel their anticipation? Do you feel my stammer? This is the talk I talk. Masunda speaks from a position of pain and vulnerability, asking for empathy and understanding. Her language is clear, honest, and upfront, and she positions herself very clearly as separate and far away from her listener. This is a real migrant experience, but it is not my reality, and therefore not my truth. In the 20 years since I moved to Ireland, among other things, I felt alone, isolated, and abandoned by the very concept of belonging. But how can someone like me talk about abandonment from a position of privilege? I'm a middle-class, white, educated European woman who has lived in the leafy suburbs of Dublin. Many people would gladly walk my walk. And yet, my migrant truth was loneliness. But because I censored myself for feeling this way, because I felt I had no right to feel this way, I ended up hiding this truth in the language of my poems. The first poem I'm going to read demonstrates what I mean by this. It is about being suspended in flight just before a plane lands. At the stage of my life when I wrote this, I internalized that wise Irish saying, suck it up, when I was feeling depressed. I thought things would get better and I would arrive in Irish society. But what I felt inside was different. While everyone applauded me for my achievements, I felt like Christ's disciples when they walked into the empty tomb and found nothing but a cloth left behind. I was empty. So this poem is called Passage. As the plane banks on a soapy blanket of clouds, the broken shoulder of a mountain appears. It is here, midway between sky and land, that she thinks of the stitching her grandmother taught her. Thread the needle, punch the cloth, go under, come back up again, she said. She wishes she could follow her and darn the waning sun into her thoughts, carefully lining her eyes with silky white smoke. It's getting dark, and the fog is reluctant to clear. The airport must be near. Little blue lights blink. At touch them, there is applause and cheers. A cloth left behind, wrapped in a place by itself. The truth of migrant isolation is very deep. It's not that people are not kind, it's the little things. It's, for example, when you're asked every week where you're from and when you're going home, you start realizing that many Irish people don't see you as being at home, and that makes you feel very invisible. One of my reactions to this sense of invisibility was that I started to obsessively think about ways of figuring out and putting into words who I was in Ireland. I kept failing because I didn't feel I fitted into any category. I obviously wasn't Irish enough, but with an Irish family and no exotic backstory, I wasn't migrant enough either. And then I heard about this mathematical concept of the imaginary number, and that struck a chord with me. So listen to the definition. An imaginary number is a complex number that can be written as a real number multiplied by the imaginary unit I. So I thought that made perfect sense. And I wrote a poem about it. So this poem is called Get Mathematical. Think about an imaginary number, all the dead branches scattered on the road, the multiple raindrops bothering your window, the number of times you scattered yourself among strangers. Where do you go from here? Squared, you'll never be greater than zero. Yet, if you capitulate to the grayness seeping into your foliage, you might learn to understand the meaning of I. Capitulation was at the center of my migrant experience. I thought I must work hard at fitting in, become more Irish than the Irish themselves, imitate, be quiet, suppress, accept, and then I will surely get that lecturing job and will develop a sense of belonging at last. Well, that didn't happen, but I gave birth to three beautiful children here, and the days rolled into one another. I wasn't writing much poetry, but what I wrote betrayed this sense of retreat, as if I saw the world in slow motion, with just a hint of doubt seeping in here and there. So this feeling is captured in this next poem, Rituals. I go downstairs and check. I see my foot trailing behind me, grabbing the carpet, the dust. I see my hand dancing and curiously touching the rails, the window, and even my eyebrow. My hair, grumpy and still sleeping, follows at a distance, and my mouth dreams of strawberry toothpaste. Downstairs, I gather up my limbs and open the door, pick up the milk, and hold them tight. To the kitchen, tiny white drops follow. Line of dots under question marks. This was a slow time with slow poetry. I felt completely inadequate when it came to choosing the right topic for writing poetry. I felt I should stand out by writing about something interesting and publishable, like migrant identities or contemporary politics, and not about bringing in the milk. I did write about these things, but only academically, since this was about reality and not the truth. Excuse me. My truth was about inconsequence and invisibility, and about not wanting to hear those voices that nagged at me to change. Like in this poem, Leaves. My weeping fig shook its leaves off in a fit of temper. I remember pulling on my scarf, slowly untreading a long conversation about winding paths in a silent landscape. I sweep off the leaves sometime before their creepy veins scribble another mutinous sentence. I listen to the brush, the silent yielding of the pan, and think about the opacity of autumn nights. Looking back now, some poems did betray a little bit more than a passing discomfort with my situation. I felt trapped, suffocated, unfulfilled, unseen and unheard. But I also knew that partly it was me who kept myself prisoner. This poem addresses this. This is called The Silent House. This silent house shelters my feral desire. I draw on its doors with blue ink and repaint its windows a rosy kind of shade. It's a big house, and the crisscross pattern of the parquet points me in paradoxical directions. So I prefer just to lie down in the hallway, scrape the walls with blunt fingers, deeply inhale yesterday's dust, and trace your forbidden body with half-shut flaming eyes. Around this time, I started to accept that my sense of belonging isn't going to come from the outside. And for me, it's going to be a very painful inward journey of deciding what to do, and more importantly, finding out who I am. I experienced this as a push and pull sensation, where nothing and everything made sense. It was a vulnerable and changeable time that I wrote about in this next poem called Mutability. I suppose I wanted to capture how the loss of what's past and the fear of what is yet to come kept me paralyzed. Mutability. She thinks of the waves, the sand silting over her feet with every push, with every pull. How do you lose the word, she wonders, which, like salt, clings to your face, your eyes? Among the scurrying crabs, she's a faceless, tongueless foreigner foraging for her past. On land, with shoals of wave-struck kelp, she glistens, shivering in the incoming tide. I slowly started making friends with the new me, who accepted that change is inevitable. I was fearful, paralyzed, but the new me was brave and reckless and pushed me towards change. I called her my strange friend and wrote a poem about her. It's called Introspection, and it describes a party where I suddenly thought of an old love, but I realized that this was really the new me who was making me see the world in a new way. Introspection. Fog has spilled milk on the window. Last night, my strange friend pollinated my house with small talk, left rosy half moons on my wine glasses, and waltzed away with my sobriety. The litter of leaves outside my window slurs into a dizzy whirlpool as I think of you. I used to love your eyebrows, those faultless black arches over naive innocence. You whistled Bach in perfect harmony and tucked your white vest into threadbare cordons. Last night, you swam into my mind uninvited among the drunken chit-chat, only my strange friend noticing your presence in my eyes. My strange friend, who doesn't know me, but sees everything. She's warmth around my cold ankles, a studded belt around my waist. The stone I threw into the lake has made a perfect eye. That stone I threw into the quiet lake of my life did indeed see and therefore change everything. My life turned upside down, and I wasn't prepared to accept invisibility and helplessness any longer. I started to take charge of what I could, and I saw how dangerous that was. It was like climbing a very fragile high tower and checking out the path ahead from above, being scared of falling and destroying everything in the process. This is what I describe in the next poem, which is called "The Heart is a Dangerous Place." She climbed through the weather door and looked down at the worrying field. The street below was empty. Only a stray dog lifted his leg against the wall. The tower was held together with iron stumps, frozen in time with molten lead. Little Gothic faces protruded from the walls. Cathedrals like this often suffered structural failure. Roofs fell in. Today, she held on with her right hand, while her left kept her hair from filling her mouth. Inside, there was no wind, only startled pigeons' noisy flutter. Up here, the air is pure and sweet like an angel's breath, she thought. Then she climbed down, descended step by step, because taking her body made perfect sense. Finding the truth of my migrant experience has been a slow process of taking my body and learning to become myself again. From today's vantage point, I see the process of change much more clearly. But for many years, I was mute because I was only paying attention to what was real, and that's never enough. This is why it's so important to think outside of the tyranny of subject matter when it comes to minority writers. Often migrants are overwhelmed and muted and can't quite talk about how they are settling in or how they are connecting to the host country because their truth lies hidden behind their everyday experience. And people find different ways to cope. One of the things that has helped me most in this painful period of discovery was making connections not with stories but with other poets' truths. Much of my poetical thinking is inspired by how Elaine writes about silence, or Maeve McGuckian about pain, or Harry Clifton about encountering others, or Ava Burke about music. These poets indeed tell us the truth and fill the mind with light. For me, Irish poets are my Shakespearean Prospero, my magician who emptied the cupboard of my mind of useless dead things and filled it with fire. So I would like to close today's reading by saying how grateful I am for their words and dedicating this last poem to all the Irish poets who found their way to my truth, because as Attila Yosef rightly said, without each other, all is night. So this last poem is called Prospero. You stood there and took out the silver, one by one, and threw them on the floor. The vase, the tray, the candlestick, all the forks and knives, gone. The huge cupboard stood empty, barren, expectant. Then you picked up the burning logs and tenderly arranged them inside, one at a time, filling the space with smoke and the smell of scorched flesh. Are you out of your mind? I asked, but you laughed and closed the door. Now I'm staring at the cupboard, half thinking that the frail snakes of smoke escaping from its hair with cracks will wrap themselves around my ankles and lift me up slowly, unbelieving. Then I could see the inside of your laughing mouth and could count the fire syllables escaping your throat. I could reach out and touch your hand, but instead, I'm quietly bursting into flames.